I met Tom Long in the mid-1980s when I was working for the General Board of Discipleship in the area of preaching. I had the privilege of meeting with the Academy of Homiletics, the teachers of preaching. And Tom was then teaching at Princeton Theological Seminary. He was already one of the preeminent teachers of preaching. So when Fred Craddock retired from the Bandy Chair of Preaching at Candler School of Theology, Emory University, they went searching for the best person they could possibly find to go into that particular place. And they found Tom Long. Tom has been teaching at Candler School of Theology for all these years, has recently retired, and is now the Bandy Professor Emeritus of Preaching. It's a delight for me to introduce to you my friend and one of the great preachers and teachers of preachers in the United States and the world, Tom Long. Tom?
Well, thank you, Michael, and thank you all for coming. I'm honored and humbled to be a part of this lecture series. I'm impressed you'd give a valuable Saturday in the fall, football weekend and all, to come out. I'm also delighted to be a part of a series that would honor Bishop and Mrs. Clark. I know what a profound memory their presence here in this congregation was. I also am impressed that this church has a lecture series like this. We're told to love the Lord our God with our heart and soul and mind and heart, and I think it's the mind part that sometimes gets left off. And for this lecture series to stand as a way of an engagement with the Christian faith in our minds. What I want to do in the next couple of hours is to look at this very intriguing and engaging form of teaching and preaching that Jesus did through parables. And I want us to look at some of the texts. Do they all have the handouts? You all have handouts? Great, because we're going to be looking at some of the texts. We sometimes think of parables as just stories that Jesus told. But they're really more dramatic and profound than that. The Gospel of Mark said, Jesus never said anything except in parables. It's a bit of an exaggeration. He said things not in parables, but the point is well taken. It was his signature way of proclaiming the gospel and the kingdom. And sometimes we think of these stories that he told sort of like sermon illustrations. But they weren't. They weren't just stories about the kingdom. Biblical scholars have been teaching us that these were experiences and expressions of the kingdom in linguistic form. That is to say, when you encountered a parable, you didn't just learn something about the kingdom, you experienced in the very expression of the parable the kingdom itself. Clarence Jordan has an even better way to put it. You may know that name. He was a famous Georgia Southern Baptist progressive preacher, founded Koinonia Farms, and also helped to establish Habitat for Humanity. And he said that whenever Jesus told a parable, it was as if he lit a stick of dynamite and covered it with a story. Something would happen, an eventfulness of the parable. Now, what in the world is a parable? Well, Jesus didn't invent parables. He inherited them. They were a form of Jewish teaching. The Old Testament word for parable, the Hebrew word, is mashal, mashal. And when the Septuagint, the English translation of the Old Testament, was produced, the Greek word is parabole, parable. Now, what are mashal and parabole? Let's take a look at some examples in the Bible of mashal and parabole. They're on your handout as the first items. The first one comes from 1 Samuel 10, and it involves King Saul. And King Saul is in a royal retinue, traveling back to the palace, and here's the description of what happened. When they were going from there to Gibeah, a band of prophets met him, and the Spirit of God possessed him, and he fell into a prophetic frenzy along with them. When all who knew him before saw how he prophesied with the prophets, the people said to one another, "What has come over the son of Kish? Is Saul also among the prophets?" A man of the place answered, "And who is their father?" Therefore, it became a mashal, a parable, translated proverb here. Is Saul also among the prophets? Now, what's happening here is the king and his company are traveling from one place to another. And as the limousine and the entourage happen to be passing along through the countryside, there's a group of ecstatic prophets out prophesying in the wilderness. Now, these are not the established and significant prophets like Isaiah and Ezekiel and Jeremiah and Daniel. These prophets are ecstatic, frenzied prophets. They're sort of like Pentecostal holiness preachers. And they get the anointing as they dance in a kind of frenzy out there and spewing out the word of God. This is the kind of folk that a king is supposed to avoid. But in this particular case, the king's entourage is ordered to stop, and astonishingly, to the shock of everybody, Saul gets out of the chariot and walks over and goes into a trance and begins prophesying with the prophets, and people begin to whisper. What does he think he's doing? What's come over him? Does he think he's one of these prophets? And it became a parable. Is Saul also among the prophets? What that means is, it became a portable saying. Whenever somebody loses their mind in public, you can say about them, is Saul also among the prophets? Tom Long in a faculty meeting, sleepy faculty meeting, nothing happening. And suddenly he stands up and begins to pound the desk and to make a ferocious speech about some minor issue of policy, and the rest of the faculty whisper, does Tom Long think he's one of the prophets? Okay, here's the first example of mashal. It's not a story like the prodigal son, is it? It's a saying that's attached to something. Here's another one from the book of Job. My spirit is broken. My days are extinct. The grave is ready for me. You remember Job's experience. He was afflicted with a number of tragedies, and here he is crying out in the midst of his distress. Surely there are mockers around me, and my eye dwells on their provocation. Lay down a pledge for me with yourself. Who is there who will give surety for me? You've closed their minds to understanding, therefore it will not let them triumph. Those who denounce friends for reward, the eyes of their children will fail. God has made me a mashal of the people. So Job, in the depth of his suffering, crying out to God, crying out to humanity, crying out in despair, says, God has turned me into a parable. Here's a third one in Ezekiel. The word of the Lord came to me. O mortal, propound a riddle and speak a mashal, translated here, allegory, to the house of Israel. Say, thus says the Lord God, a great eagle with great wings and long pinions, rich in plumage of many colors, came to the Lebanon. He took the top of the cedar, broke off its topmost shoot. He carried it to a land of trade, set it in a city of merchants. Then he took a seed from the land and placed it in fertile soil, and so on. Now, if you know how to interpret this one, this is a clear allegory, but it's called a parable. The great eagle is Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon. By the way, the little part of that name, Nezer, that actually means big bird, like Sesame Street. And so the big bird concept gets turned into a great eagle. And he's got a great plumage of many colors. He comes to the Lebanon and takes the top of the cedar, that's Palestine. He broke off its topmost shoot. That's the king, young King Jehoiakim. So this is an allegory about the Babylonian captivity, but it is called a mashal. It's a parable. Two more on the next sheet. These are both from the New Testament. Then Jesus called the crowd again and said to them, listen to me, all of you, and understand. There is nothing outside a person that by going in can defile, but the things that come out are what defile. When he left the crowd and entered the house, his disciples asked him about the parable. In other words, a saying now is a parable. a saying like, there's nothing that from the outside going in can defile you. It's the stuff that's inside you coming out. That's what's a defilement. And that's a parable. Luke 4. He said to them, doubtless you will quote to me this proverb, but the Greek is parabole, parable. Doctor, cure yourself, and you will say, do here also in your hometown the things that we've heard you did at Capernaum. So a proverb is now called a parable. We're a long way away from the prodigal son when we're talking about Job being a parable, an allegory being a parable, a saying being a parable. What in the world is a parable? Well, I would like to suggest in all of these cases, there is an ambiguity at work. That is to say, it is not exactly clear in any of the cases exactly what we are to understand from these. How is Job an example or a symbol or a parable of something? You have to figure that out. And as a matter of fact, the very word itself, parable, has this ambiguity built into it. It's a glued together word from two Greek terms, para and bole. Bole means to place down, to set down. And para means alongside. To set something alongside something else and to suggest that there's a meaning to be found in the placement of the two together. The kingdom of heaven is like, means that we place the kingdom of heaven down next to something that isn't the kingdom of heaven. And the interpreter has to figure out the electricity between the two things. There is an intentional ambiguity built into the use of mashal and parabole, and it was Jesus' favorite method of teaching. You know, every now and then in theological debates in the church, somebody will say, the Bible clearly teaches. No, it doesn't. Anybody who says about almost anything important that the Bible clearly teaches probably misunderstands the Scripture. And right at the heart of Jesus' teaching, there is this, I'm going to put the kingdom of God down to next to something that isn't the kingdom of God, and you have to figure out. There's a self-involving character to the nature of Jesus' teaching. And that leads us to the next question. Why then did Jesus choose to teach in parables? Why didn't he squat down in the sand, as he did when the woman was caught in adultery, and write in the sand with his finger and write clearly, like, okay, fellas, here's the doctrine of the Trinity, and here's the doctrine of Christology, and here's what the church is supposed to do. No, he chose to teach in parables. Why did he do that? Well, the fascinating thing about that is, there is already a theological dispute about that, even in the New Testament. The gospel writers don't agree with each other about why it was that Jesus wanted to teach in parables. We can spot it most clearly in the distinctiveness and the characteristic distinction between the Gospel of Mark and the Gospel of Matthew. If you'll take a look in your handout at Mark 4, and we're going to look starting at the 10th verse. When Jesus was alone, those who were around him, along with the 12, I've always thought that was an interesting construction. When Jesus was alone, those who were around him, those who were around him, along with the 12, asked him about the parables. How come you teach in parables? He said to them, to you has been given the secret of the kingdom. But for those outside, everything comes in parables, in order that they may indeed look but not perceive, and may indeed listen but not understand, so that they may not turn again and be forgiven. In other words, to the question put to him by his disciples and others, why in the world do you talk in parables? Jesus says, the reason I talk in parables is so they won't understand what I'm talking about. Now, Matthew had a copy of the Gospel of Mark when he wrote his Gospel. So let's look at this scene of the exchange between Jesus and the disciples about parables when it gets to the Gospel of Matthew. And if you'll take a look at Matthew 13, which is at the bottom of page 4 on your handout. Matthew is merrily copying Mark and putting the same stories in that Mark has, making his changes here and there. And he gets down to this exchange, and let's look at verse 10 in Matthew 13. Then the disciples came and asked him, "Why do you speak to them in parables?" He answered, "To you it has been given to know the secrets of the kingdom of heaven, but to them it has not been given. For to those who have, more will be given, and they will have an abundance. But from those who have nothing, even what they have will be taken away. The reason I speak to them in parables is that seeing they don't perceive, and hearing they don't listen, nor do they understand." That's a quotation from Isaiah. But what has been changed here is one little Greek word. In Mark, the word is hina, so that. Why do you teach in parables? So that they won't understand what I'm talking about. Matthew changes hina to hoti in order that. Because. Why do you teach in parables? Because they don't understand. So in Matthew, Jesus teaches in parables in order to help them out because they don't get it yet. In Mark, he teaches in parables in order to keep them in the dark, to make them even more confused. Now, why in the world would Matthew and Mark have these radically different understandings? Most of us, by the way, are a lot happier with Matthew than we are with Mark. The idea of Jesus using parables to keep people confused and at a distance seems strange to us. But I would like to suggest that these are actually two sides of the same coin, that there is something about a parable that both conceals and reveals. And that is intrinsic to the nature of the gospel, that if you think you can get the gospel like that, like it's lying out there on the surface just to be grabbed, low-hanging fruit, you probably misunderstand the gospel. You know, sometimes our students in seminary will say to us, when they have been out and been in the church for a couple of years, "You never told us it was like this." As if we were trying to deprive them of information. But the truth of the matter is that there are some experiences in life, like doing ministry or being married or being a parent, that you can't talk about before people go through it. That there's something ineffable about it. And there is something about the nature of the gospel that requires a kind of seasoned reframing of our imagination before we can catch it. And Mark is trying to lift up that part of it. Matthew is trying to pick up the other side of it. That finally, when all is said and done, it is the intention of God to make every aspect of the nature of the good life, the liberated life, the responsible, gospel-oriented life, available to everyone. So like a bicycle rider, Mark pushes down on this pedal, and Matthew pushes down on this pedal. By the way, this is built, this notion of secrecy that ultimately comes out, is in the whole framework of the Gospel of Mark. You may remember that the first verse of Mark's Gospel is, "This is the beginning of the good news about Jesus the Messiah, the Son of God." Or to rephrase it, Genesis. The word that's translated beginning is actually the Greek word for the Hebrew word Genesis. This is the new Genesis about Jesus, who has two titles. He's Messiah, Christ, and he's Son of God. Now the Messiah is the strong part. This is the one who's going to restore the Davidic Empire and reestablish the fortunes of the people of God. The Son of God image is drawn from the Psalms and the servant songs, and that's the weaker part. He had no loveliness that we should look at him, but he bore our griefs and carried our sorrows. And this is the good news about Jesus, who is both Christ and Son of God. Now, you get that in verse 1. It's 8 chapters before anybody else finds it out. Oh, a few demons, but just you and the demons, that's all who know. And questions are asked early in Mark. Who is this who can forgive even sin? And you, the reader, say, come on, guys, that's Jesus. He's the Messiah and the Son of God. Well, who is this who can command even the wind and the waves? That's Jesus. He's Messiah and Son of God. And then we get to Caesarea Philippi. Who do people say that I am? Some people say you're John the Baptist. Bzzzt. Some people say you're one of the prophets. Bzzzt. Who do you say that I am? You're the Messiah. But he doesn't say the other half. He gets the strong part right, but not the cross, not the suffering part. So hollow is that moment that some scribes in some manuscripts have inserted Son of God in there as if Peter got it all right there, but he didn't get it all right. He ran in the middle of the gospel. We have to go all the way to the cross. And when Jesus is hanging on the cross in the Gospel of Mark, a Roman centurion looks up at the cross and says, that is the Son of God. You don't understand the gospel, is the point Mark is making, until you go to the cross. And until you go to the cross, the reason I speak in parables is so they won't misunderstand by thinking they understand too early. Only when we get done with this story will you know that this was the Christ only by being the suffering Son of God. Now, how did we get the parables that we have in the New Testament that Jesus told? Well, it's an intricate and interesting process. We think that Jesus, as a roving teacher and preacher, spoke parables here and there. If you count them up, his repertoire was about 40 parables, and he spoke them in this occasion, and he spoke them on that occasion, and sometimes he spoke them in a different kind of context than the last time he spoke that story, and people heard them, and they remembered them. Now, when Jesus was crucified in the early 30s, it's going to be a generation before we get our first gospel written down. So you've got a couple or three decades or more where there isn't anything written down. All there is the oral memory. And so the church would tell Jesus' stories in their own context. When they would be experiencing something, they would say, oh, you know, that reminds me of that story that Jesus told about a man who had two sons. And they retell the story. Well, if you've ever been in a parlor game where you sit in a circle and somebody whispers to the person next to them something and they're supposed to whisper to somebody else until it gets back around, it is always the case that there's some changes by the time that it gets around. And these are not mistakes or nefarious changes. These are changes resulting from the parables being used in new contexts. Our concern as people of the 21st century is often, what exactly did Jesus say? What was it exactly what he said? You may remember that in one of the great moments in history was when Abraham Lincoln was on his deathbed. He was surrounded by members of his staff and his cabinet. And when he breathed his last, the Secretary of War, Edwin Stanton, was there, and everybody kind of looked to Stanton, who was a figure of great prominence in the cabinet, to say something appropriate. And so what he said was, as Lincoln died, now he belongs to the ages. Or did he? Some people remember it, that what he said was, now he belongs to the angels. So did he say ages? Or did he say angels? And American historians, this is a big point of argument, you know. Was it one or the other? I, by the way, think it was angels. That seems like the kind of thing you say when somebody passes away. But, of course, as the kind of civic figure that Lincoln is to us now, ages is a more civic appropriate way to understand it. But there's a debate about what exactly did Stanton say. Well, in biblical studies, there is also a debate about what Jesus exactly said. That was not the concern of people in the first century so much, because they believed that Jesus was continuing to speak as the risen Christ. And so when they recalled a parable that Jesus had spoken in his earthly ministry, but recalled it in a new setting, it would change a little bit. And they didn't think this was a loss. This was an addition, because now Jesus was continuing to speak in continuity with what he had said before to a new situation. So the parables that we have in the New Testament are not, for the most part, exactly what Jesus said in his earthly ministry. They are, in one sense, preaching about what Jesus said in new contexts. Now, some scholars think that we can unroll, we get the toothpaste back in the tube, and we can sort of figure out what was it that Jesus actually originally said. The most famous scholar who thought he could do that was Joachim Jeremias, a German scholar, and he said, you know, there are certain rules about how these changes have occurred. For example, Jesus spoke in Aramaic, and the Aramaic word for banquet is the same word in Greek as wedding feast. Banquet and wedding feast are the same word. So we have parables that come from Jesus that are about banquets, and we have parables about wedding feasts. So Jeremiah said originally they were about the same event, but they get split off because the Greek word can go either way. Or the early church was facing the fact that Jesus was not coming back soon. We thought he was going to come back soon, but the days and the years and the decades went on. And so hints of the delay. The master was gone for a long time, some of the parables in the New Testament will say, reflecting the new experience of the church that the kingdom was not coming soon. Jeremias formulated about 12 of these rules. Now, if you know the rules of how it got changed, what you can do, said Jeremias, is take a parable in the New Testament and turn the gears the other way, take out all the rules, and there you would have the original parable. People said, ah. But then in 1945, in a cave at Nag Hammadi, they found some manuscripts, including the Gospel of Thomas. And there in the Gospel of Thomas was a parable coming from the mouth of Jesus exactly in the form that Jeremias had reconstructed. So there is some validity to the claim, I think, that we can try to figure out with some proximity what Jesus originally said over against what we have in the New Testament. But I personally don't value one more than I do the other, because I think there's a trajectory of Jesus speaking through time. So tomorrow morning I'm going to try to preach on one of the parables in the Gospel of Luke. I don't think that parable in Luke is exactly as Jesus said it, but standing behind it is something Jesus said. And it moves through Luke and through the generations that have come after Jesus and Luke. And tomorrow morning it will take on a new form in this congregation, and I hope it will be Jesus speaking, if you get the point, each time in a new situation. Here's an example of the kind of diversity we find about parables in the New Testament. You may remember in Luke 15, it's not on your handout, the Jewish leaders are gathering around Jesus and they're grumbling. He eats with sinners, he associates with sinners, and he eats with them. And so Jesus turns to them and says, you listen to me. If you had 100 sheep and one of them got lost, all right, there's the telling of the parable of the one little lost sheep. Now let's take a look on your handout at that same parable as it appears in Matthew 18. And that'll be on page 6. Now, the whole chapter of Matthew 18 is about how do you take care of people in the church. It starts off with a conversation about leadership. And then in verse 12, it gets to this. What do you think? If a shepherd has 100 sheep and one of them has gone astray, does he not leave the 99 on the mountains and go in search of the one that went astray? And if he finds it, truly I tell you, he rejoices over it more than over the 99 that never went astray. So it's not the will of your Father in heaven that one of these little ones should be lost. Now, in Luke, Jesus is under attack. And he uses the parable of the lost sheep as a way of defending his ministry to sinners. In Matthew 18, the same story roughly appears, but Jesus is not under attack. He's in a conversation about leadership with his disciples. And he's telling them that they ought to extend pastoral care to the weak and the lost in the congregation. So the context is entirely different. Now, maybe Jesus told it two ways. Or maybe he told it one way, and Luke and Matthew have their own ways of applying it. Whenever I read the story about pastoral care and the little lost sheep, I go all the way back in my memory to my first year as a parish minister in Atlanta. And one day, I had a member of my congregation who was sick and who was at Emory University Hospital. And so I went over to see this parishioner, and my parents at the time lived near Emory University Hospital, and I thought, I'll kill two birds with one stone. I'll visit my parents on the way to the hospital. So I did. I visited my parents for a while, and then I said, well, I guess I better be shoving off. I've got somebody sick at Emory University Hospital, and so I'm going to be on my way. And my mother said, oh, one of my dear friends from around the corner, she's been at Emory for 2 weeks, and I know she would dearly love to have a visit from you. Well, you can imagine how I responded to that, which was, you know, Mother, I'm a very busy man. I have my own church, and I can't be responsible for changing my schedule every time one of your bridge partners gets sick. That wasn't exactly the way I put it to her. I think the way I put it to her was, yes, Mother, I'll be happy to visit your friend in the hospital. So I went by this woman's room, and there was a sign on the door that said, no visitors, family only. So I went to the nurse's station, I explained the situation, and the head nurse says, let me check. So she went into her room, and she came out, and she said, she'd like to see you. So I went into the room, and there she was. She was propped up, pillows behind her head. She had this little bird-like face, her eyes darting around the room. And I said, hi, I'm Tom Long. You don't know me. I'm a Presbyterian minister, but you know my mother. And without warning, she said, what is the meaning of the biblical name Elisha? I scrambled to remember some Hebrew. El means God, Ish means man, Elisha, man of God, is what I said. That's not what it means. Satisfied her, though. She said, sit down, I've been looking for a minister who knows something. And when I sat down and had a conversation with her, I found a very frightened woman fighting a terminal illness who had been visited by no one, not even her pastor. So, at the end of the visit, I read a psalm, I had a prayer, and I said, I'll come back. A few days later, I came back, and the sign on the door had changed. It said, no visitors, family only, and then in crayon, there was a flower drawn, and under the flower, it said, please. Well, I went to the nurse's station. She said, let me check. She came out, and she said she'd like to see you. So, I visited with her. She was struggling with her faith. And at the end of the visit, I read a psalm, I had a prayer, and I said, I'll come back. And a few days later, I went back, and the sign was changed again. No visitors, family only. The flower was scrawled out, and underneath it, it said, and this means you. I went to the nurse's station, she checked, and she came out, and she said, she doesn't want to see anybody. And that afternoon, all alone, she passed over to the other side. A frail Presbyterian minister could not hold on. as she passed through to the other side. But at her funeral, we were bold to sing songs of resurrection, because we know that the frailty of human pastoral care depends upon the fidelity of God's care, and that on the other side, there was a good shepherd who lifted her up on his strong shoulders and took her home. Now, that's how Matthew understands this parable. It's a beautiful understanding of it. It's not how Luke understands it, but we get this way of turning these gems in the light so that we begin to see the different facets of them. Now, I would like to talk for a few minutes about some of the characteristics of Jesus' parables. Just a few of them, and then I want us to look at how Mark handles the parables and how Matthew handles the parables and how Luke handles the parables. The first characteristic actually comes from Paul Ricoeur, the philosopher theologian, French philosopher theologian, and I wish I had a good French accent because it sounds so much better with a French accent. He says that all of the parables have the characteristic of extravagance. They're extravagant. That is to say, in almost every single parable that we have in the New Testament, there's something over the top. And that this is characteristic of the kingdom of God. There's something that bubbles over our expectation. For example, the very first parable that Jesus tells in the Gospel of Mark, and the very first parable in Matthew's long string of parables in Matthew 13, is about a farmer, and he goes out sowing seed, and some of the seed falls on hard ground, and it doesn't spring up, doesn't do very well, and some of it falls on rocky ground, and it doesn't do very well either, and some of it falls on thorny ground, and the thorns choke the plants when it comes up, but then the seed falls on good soil. And in Mark, a bumper crop, 30-fold, 60-fold, 100-fold. And Matthew says, well, contain yourself, 100-fold, 60-fold, well, maybe 30-fold. He reverses the numbers. But in each case, at the end of the parable, disappointment after disappointment after disappointment is met with extravagance. Now, sometimes in commentaries, the biblical scholar will say, this parable reflects agricultural methods in the ancient Near East. Baloney. No farmer has ever been so stupid as the farmer in this parable. You know, hard ground. Woo! Sure. Rocky ground, of course. Thorns. Nobody sows seed like that. Except God. You know, who flings out the gospel in unpromising places. And then at the end of things, there is this bubbling over the top of extravagance. Paul Tillich, in one of his sermons, said about this parable, the history of God's people is a history of people who have not been afraid to waste themselves. They waste themselves and their love like God wastes his. So the first characteristic of Jesus' parables is don't expect them to end with a neat closure. There is going to be some surprise in the parable that bubbles over the top because that's the impact, the linguistic impact of the kingdom, extravagance. The second characteristic of Jesus' parables is reversal. It's not in every parable, but it's at the heart of most parables that something happens in which the thing that is least gets to be the thing that's most, and the thing that's most gets turned into the thing that's least. This, too, is characteristic of the kingdom. You know, what is your most important possession? Is it the Van Gogh that hangs in your living room? And I know it does. Or is it the rubber life raft that's in your garage? Well, it depends on whether the dam has broken or not. When the dam breaks, the Van Gogh can go. And the rubber life raft becomes the thing that saves our lives. So it is with the parable. When the kingdom emerges, when the kingdom advents, then suddenly that which was valuable to us is diminished. And that which was ignored by us becomes important to us. John Dominic Crossan, a biblical scholar who's written an interesting book on the parables, says that he thinks that the key parables in Jesus' repertoire are the little parables of the treasure hidden in the field and the pearl of great price. Let's take a look at them. They're in Matthew 13. It's page 5, Matthew 13. The kingdom of heaven is like treasure hidden in a field, which someone found and hid. Then in his joy he goes and sells all that he has and buys that field. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant in search of fine pearls. On finding one pearl of great value, he went and sold all that he had and bought it. Now, why does John Dominic Crossan think those two little parables are the central parables of Jesus' parabolic ministry? Because, he said, they both have the same plot structure. Advent, reversal, action. Advent, reversal, action. In both parables, something advents, something comes onto the screen suddenly. Now, in the first one, it comes unexpectedly. A man is whistling and plowing a field, and suddenly the plow blade hits something clunky, and he thinks it's probably a rock, and he reaches down, and lo and behold, it's a jar with gold coins in it. A treasure has advented. In the second parable, the merchant is looking for just the right pearl. And that's not it. No, that's not it. Searchings. Oh, now you're talking. There it is. In one case, an accident. In one case, a quest. But in both cases, something advents. And then there is a reversal. Everything that used to be valuable to these two people is no longer. They sell everything in order to acquire the field and the pearl. The past is not valuable anymore. The future opened up by this advent is now what we're putting our investment in. And action. They actually did sell and buy. Advent, reversal, action. And Crossan says all of the other parables of Jesus tend to be parables of advent, parables of reversal, or parables of action, but here we have the master plot that underlies them all. So important is this plot scheme, said Crossan, that what is really found in these parables and in the kingdom, in the gospel, is not the treasure or the pearl, but the person. They have a future they didn't have before. The reversal has opened up something that was not even apparent to them before. When my son David was 4 years old, he's now a professor at William & Mary, but when he was 4 years old, he wanted for Christmas an HO gauge electric train. That's what he asked Santa Claus for. Now, that's the little one, you know, the little tiny one. He really wasn't old enough at four for a little tiny, but that's what he wanted. Wrote a letter to Santa Claus. So Santa Claus got him an HO gauge electric train. When he and his sister were down for the night, sugar plums dancing in their heads, Santa Claus went up into the attic to get the HO gauge electric train. So I got the train, and I got the big 4x8 piece of plywood that we were going to put the track on, and I got the little tiny surgical steel spikes that you hammer down the track. And then I went to my toolbox to get my tack hammer and my blue-handled long-nosed pliers in order to hold these little nails. I found the tack hammer, but I couldn't find the pliers. So I said to my wife, "Have you seen my blue-handled long-nosed pliers?" She said, "Yeah." David was playing with them in the backyard this afternoon. If it weren't Christmas Eve, I'd get him out of the bed, put a flashlight in his hand, and make him go find them. But that's bad form on Christmas Eve. So I just held the little tiny spikes in my hand and tacked them in. And by, 6:30 or 7 in the morning, I'd done it. blue bruises on both of my fingers, but it was fine. It was a wonderful Christmas. He loved the H.O. Gage electric train. And then we went to get some dinner at the dinner table, and before we could get there, David pulled on my bathrobe and said, Daddy, you forgot one of your presents. And there in last week's funny papers and 200 feet of scotch tape, there was a present for me from David. And I opened it up, and there they were, my blue-handled long-nosed pliers. And I looked at David and the expression on his face, and I realized what was lost and now found were not my pliers, but my relationship with my son. That this Advent had opened up a future, a relationship, a life for us. And there is this reversal quality in the parables of Jesus that opens up a future. We can make a long list, but the last characteristic I want to talk about this morning is confrontation. Jesus' parables, properly understood, are not gentle. There's something in them that revolutionizes, reforms our world. For example, take a look at Matthew 13 again, 13:33. He told them another parable. The kingdom of heaven is like yeast that a woman took and mixed in with 3 measures of flour until it was all leavened. Now that's a gentle sounding thing, isn't it? The kingdom of heaven is like yeast that a woman took and mixed in with 3 measures of flour until it was all leavened. I am ashamed of the sermons I have preached on this parable, because they have been Mickey Mouse little sermons. They have been, isn't the kingdom wonderful? It starts so small, you know, like a little bit of yeast, but then it pervades the whole loaf until all of it is... No. Almost every word in this parable, short as it is a confrontation. Now imagine Jesus telling this parable. Imagine a first century Jewish didactic setting. What are we imagining here? It's Jesus basically surrounded by men. And he says, the kingdom of heaven, and as soon as he utters those words, into their brains go what they have always imagined about the rule of God, what all of us have imagined about the rule of God. It's the rule of God is God taking charge of things and making the world like I want. It's making the world right as I see it in my own eyes. And in fact, in the competence of the day, it was the establishment of the power of Israel again. The establishment of the power of America. The establishment of the power of the Methodist Church. It's some reestablishment of a power we think we've lost. The kingdom of heaven, he says, and they imagine what they have always imagined. It's kind of like a woman. Suddenly, they are taken out of the nationalistic and power dynamics they have always associated with that term, and they're taken back into the domestic life of women. There's your first blow. It's like a woman who took yeast. Now, we think of yeast, of course, as those little Fleischmann packets that you get at the grocery store. But do you know that in the Bible, yeast is never a good word? Beware of the yeast of Herod. What kind of bread do we eat on Passover? Unleavened bread. Yeast is a corrupter. It's always understood as something that eats like an acid, like a cancer. The kingdom of heaven is like a woman who took yeast. And then the translation in the NRSV is, she mixed it in, but the Greek is not mixed. It's in crypto. She encrypted it in. She smuggled it in. Oh, this is a stealth operation taking place back in the kitchen by a woman unnoticed by the power dynamics of male society. The kingdom of heaven is more like what's happening back in the kitchen when a woman smuggles some yeast into a whole lot of flour, and then the whole thing gets corrupted. Which I think is Jesus saying to us in a kind of confrontive way, that sometimes the kingdom of heaven operates by corrupting the corruption of the world, undermining the power structures of the world. I read not long ago about a mission hospital on the Pakistani-Afghan border. And one day, many years ago, a warring Afghan tribesman was brought to the front door of that mission hospital, but stopped by the mission doctor and said, "No, I am sorry, we have no more beds available." Is he an Afghan? "Yes. I have a bed. Bring him in." Well, this wounded tribal warrior, when he was placed in that bed, was wanting to get back out and get revenge. And the doctor said, "You're too sick to move. You're too sick to get revenge. And as for revenge, when I have finished making rounds today, I'll tell you a story about revenge." Later in the day, the doctor came back into that room and told the story. Many decades before, a Brit had been appointed ambassador to Afghanistan, and as a going-away gift, his sister gave him a Book of Common Prayer. On his way to his post, he was attacked, he and his party, by a warring party of Afghans and taken to a makeshift prison. And there in prison, his Book of Common Prayer that his sister had given him was not only his solace and his devotional guide, it was also his journal. He wrote what was happening in the margins. One day, they came and got him out of his cell and summarily executed him in the middle of the camp. Another prisoner beautifully recorded this in the margins of the Book of Common Prayer. Years later, a British sailor found this Book of Common Prayer in a used bookstore, read through it, read the inscription in the front, and realized this would mean something to the family from which it came, and sought out the sister and gave her the book. And for the first time, she read what had really happened to her brother, the torture, the death, all of it. And she said, "I am going to get revenge, but it will be Christian revenge." And she took much of her life savings and endowed a bed in the mission hospital for any Afghani. The doctor looked at the patient and said, "You're in that bed. You are the victim of Christian revenge." Sometimes the kingdom says, Jesus says in a very confrontive and controversial way, proceeds by undermining the corruption of the culture. It's like yeast in a whole lot of flour, smuggled in there by a woman of no consequence. Now, I want to spend the rest of our time, and then we'll stop and breathe easy and take some time for questions and conversation. When Mark wrote his gospel, he had this repertoire of parables in the oral tradition, and when Luke wrote his gospel, he had the repertoire from the oral tradition and from Mark, and Matthew the same. And they each did their own thing with the parables of Jesus. The parables of Jesus are in service of the ministry of Jesus, but they're also in service of the theology of Mark and the theology of Luke and the theology of Matthew. And I would like to take a look at that and see how that works. Now, let's start with Mark. Mark, we think, is the poorest socioeconomically of all of the Gospels. It's addressed to a community that is impoverished. How do you know that? How do you know that? Well, there are clues in the text itself. For example, in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, Jesus sends his disciples out two by two, and he says to them, "Take no money. Take no money as you go to do ministry for me." The Greek is different, however. In Mark, it's "take no copper." Take no pennies. In Luke, it's "take no silver." Luke's a mixed economy. And in Matthew's, our first suburban affluent church, it's "take no copper, silver, or gold." They're going out doing ministry with American Express gold cards from the Gospel of Matthew, Church of Matthew. But Mark's our most impoverished one. What the challenge for Mark's gospel and the Mark's community is to understand how defeat and poverty and nothing available as resources can produce a great victory. And so let's take a look at some of the parables in Mark. Take a look at Mark 4. Let's go to verse 26. He also said, "The kingdom of God is as if someone would scatter seed on the ground and would sleep and rise night and day, and the seed would sprout and grow, he doesn't know how. The earth produces of itself, first the stalk, then the head, then the full grain in the head." Now, notice the rhythmic language of this parable. Even in the English translation, what you have in the Greek is there. He scatters seed on the ground. He sleeps and rises night and day. It sprouts and grows. Now, that rhythmic language is not by accident. Here's a farmer who has sowed some seed, and he goes to bed. He's not powerful here. Once he's sowed the seed, he's not in charge anymore. You know, he just goes to sleep, and he sleeps and rises night and day. But while he does, it's the seed itself that's beginning to take root and to sprout and to grow. And I think this is an encouragement to congregations and to Christians like Mark's and sometimes like us, who feel overpowered by the need that is around us. And, you know, our great Protestant heritage of, we're in charge of this. And if we could just get a committee and get enough money, we could solve whatever problem is out there. And what that is a kind of functional atheism, as understood in the Gospel of Mark. We're not in charge of fixing all this. This is something that God is doing. We are in charge of doing what we can. We spread the seed. But then there is a kind of holy letting go and having confidence that God is at work. Look, when I was 10 years old, my mother on a Sunday afternoon dropped me into the gravel parking lot of a little country Georgia Presbyterian church that we attended. She rolled down the window on her Studebaker and she said, "I'll be back in 2 hours. That's about how long it'll take." And she left the parking lot, gravel peeling up out of the back end of the car. And I took a deep breath because I had an appointment in the basement of the church with Inez McElroy. I went down into the basement of the church. I knew where Miss Inez would be, third Sunday school room to the right. That's where she, in fact, I thought she lived in that room. I pushed open the door, and there was Miss Inez seated behind a spare wooden table. She looked to me about the age of the Old Testament. And about the same disposition. On the table, there was a New Testament, a box of gold stars, and a children's catechism, which as a good Presbyterian, I was there to recite. Without saying a word, she nodded to me to sit down, and I sat down, and she started. "Who made you?" "God." A long, bony finger pulled a gold star out of that box, pulled it across her lizard-like tongue, and stuck it in that catechism. "Why did he make you?" "For his own good purpose." I had memorized the answers. Back and forth the questions and the answers went. And the fire of pride burned in Inez McElroy's eyes, because down there in the basement of the church, we were about the most important thing in the world. Now, for me, it was an act of memorization. But I've been a lot of places and I've done a lot of things, and I have never
learned anything more important than that God made me for God's own good purpose. Inez McElroy is dead and gone. She is sleeping the great sleep. But day and night, it grows and sprouts in me in ways that she could not have imagined and could never have controlled. And there's a beautiful insight in this parable in Mark about the capacity to do what we can and then to let it go into the providence of God. Take a look at the next parable. He also said, this is verse 30, with what can we compare the kingdom of God, and what parable will we use for it? It's like a mustard seed, when sowed upon the ground, is the smallest of all the seeds on earth, and when it is sown, it grows up and becomes the greatest shrub and puts forth large branches so that the birds of the air can make nests in its shade. With many such parables, he spoke the word to them. Now, notice how this parable, as it is uttered in Mark by Jesus, is a kind of counter-image even to what we had in Ezekiel in that mashal that we looked at earlier, where Palestine was understood to be a cedar of Lebanon. This was the image that was out there. If you wanted to get an image for the people of God, it was the tallest tree in the forest. Jesus says in Mark, to this little impoverished, struggling community of Mark, it's actually like a mustard seed. But when you plant it, and then all of a sudden you sense it turning, the reversal that you get, you want to say, and when it's planted, it becomes the cedar of Lebanon. No, when it's planted, it becomes a big shrub. Once again, a kind of feminine image over against the tallest tree in the forest. A shrub with branches so wide that every bird that's out there can find a place in it. There's a woman you don't know named Grace Thomas, no reason you should. She was the fifth child of a Birmingham, Alabama streetcar conductor who fell in love with a boy at Georgia Tech. And so she moved to Atlanta and married her sweetheart, and she became a full-time wife, and she got a job at the state capitol, and she became a full-time secretary. At the Capitol, she got interested in politics and law, and so she enrolled in Atlanta Law School, which was a night law school. So she was now a full-time wife and mother and a full-time secretary and a full-time law student. And when she graduated, she shocked her family by announcing to them that she was going to run for office. She didn't want to practice law. She was going to run for office. And her family thought, well, you know, school board, library board, what are you going to run for? I'm running for governor of Georgia. It was 1954. There were nine candidates, eight men and Grace Thomas. There were nine candidates, but there was one issue, 1954, Brown versus the Board of Education. And eight candidates said that Georgia ought to resist this with every ounce of strength that we had. Only one candidate, Grace Thomas, said, "This is the coming of justice." Her campaign slogan was, "Say grace at the polls." Not many people did. She ran dead last. And her family was relieved she'd gotten it out of her system, but she hadn't. In 1962, she ran again for governor. She also ran last, but this time the stakes were higher. The civil rights movement was beginning to take flower, and there were death threats on her life for the things that she was saying. One day, she took her campaign into Louisville, Georgia, which is, if you've ever been to Louisville, the centerpiece of Louisville is not a courthouse and not a war monument. It's a slave market where human beings were bought and sold. And Grace decided that she was going to give her campaign speech under the canopy of that market. And there was an angry gaggle of merchants and farmers gathered to hear her, and she started off this way. By the grace of God, this is over and gone. And it is time now for Georgians of all races to join together to work for peace and to work for harmony and work for justice. Somebody in the crowd said, "Are you a communist?" She said, "No." Well, where'd you get those blankety-blank ideas? She thought about it for a minute. And she pointed to the steeple of the First Baptist Church, and she said, I got them over there in Sunday school. It's a little seed. Some old teacher with a flannel graph taught Grace Thomas about the Jesus of peace and justice. And there she stood in the maelstrom of the 60s in Georgia. And it had come now to a shrub of great size, welcoming all the birds of the earth. This is what Mark is doing with the parables. It takes a seasoned life to be able to understand a parable like that, because it's so counterintuitive. The reason I talk in parables, said Jesus in Mark, is so they won't get what I'm understanding until I've gone to the cross. Then they'll get it. Then they'll get it. Take a look at Mark 13. But about that day or hour, no one knows, neither the angels in heaven nor the Son, only the Father. Now, what he's talking about there, just give you a little background. The whole 13th chapter of Mark is a discussion of the second coming, the end of time, the coming of the kingdom. When's it going to be? What's it going to be like? His disciples want to know. And so Jesus is talking about it all through Mark 13. And then he gets down to the end of it and he says, but about that day or hour, no one knows, neither the angels in heaven nor the Son, only the Father. Beware, keep alert. You don't know when the time will come. It's like a man going on a journey when he leaves home and puts his slaves in charge, each with his work, and he commands the doorkeeper, be on the watch. Therefore, keep awake. You don't know when the master of the house will come, in the evening or at midnight or at cockcrow or at dawn, or else he may find you asleep when he comes suddenly. And what I say to you, I say to all, stay awake. All right. The disciples want to know when the kingdom's coming. And Jesus says to them at the end of this discourse about the kingdom, he said, look, nobody knows the day or the hour. The angels don't know it. You don't know it. I don't even know when this is going to be. Only God in heaven knows when this is going to happen. But I'll tell you what it's going to be like. It's going to be like a man who wants to go on a journey, and he tells his servants, I want you to keep my house straight 24/7, because I could come back at any time. I'm not telling you when I'm coming back. It could be any time. In fact, it could be evening, or it could be midnight, or it could be at cockcrow, or it could be at dawn. By the way, this is one of the ways that we know that this has been adapted from what Jesus really said. Because as a Jew, Jesus would not divide the night into those four time frames, evening, midnight, cockcrow, dawn. That's a Roman way to divide the night. Jesus is a Jew. He would have divided it into three time frames, but the Romans divided it into four, and so Jesus suddenly sounds like a Roman. Well, Mark probably, his church is probably in Rome, so he takes the three and turns it into four. I could come any time. I could come in the evening. I could come at midnight. I could come at cockcrow. I could come at dawn. So, I want you to stay awake and watch. If you were to read on in Mark, one of the very next stories would be, and when it was evening, he was with his disciples and said, one of you will betray me. He could come in the evening. Or I could come at midnight. Next story in Mark. Late that night, they went to the garden. And he prayed that prayer with great sweat dropping off of him like blood. And when he came out, he found the disciples. Did you watch for an hour? I could come in the evening. I could come at midnight. I could come at cockcrow. Weren't you with him? No, I don't know him. And the cock crew. Or he could come at dawn. Mark 15:1, and when it was dawn, they handed him over to be crucified. Notice what's happening here. I could come in the evening, I could come at midnight, I could come at cockcrow, I could come at dawn. The writer of the Gospel of Mark has used those time references to describe the passion of Jesus. Which means, if you want to know when the kingdom is coming, don't just get up on your tiptoes and look out like the road signs in the South used to say, Jesus is coming soon. You know, don't get up and look on the edge of history. Look at every tick of the clock. The advent of God, the chances for loyalty and denial come at every tick of the clock. Even midnight, cockcrow, dawn, tick, tock, tick, tock. Parables in Mark. Now, when we get to the parables in Matthew, we're in a different world. Matthew's church is probably a group of people who minutes ago were in the synagogue. And because they, for reasons we don't know, believed that Jesus of Nazareth was the Messiah promised to Judaism, they either walked out or got kicked out of the synagogue. That is, by the way, why you will hear in Matthew stuff that, taken in our day, sounds anti-Semitic. But in Matthew's context, it's the fragile new Christian community that's left, for some reason, the powerful synagogue across the street. So the power dynamics are different in the Gospel of Matthew than they are in our time. It's only in Matthew that the Jewish crowd says at the crucifixion, His blood be on us and our children. Now, in Matthew's context, that's a part of an intramural synagogue fight. I put it in the hands of Mel Gibson, and you suddenly have abusive anti-Semitism. Matthew's little fragile group. And now the challenge for them is, we used to be Jews who had to figure out how our experience of Jesus fit into our Judaism. Now we're different. Now we're Christians who have to figure out how our memories of Judaism fit into our newfound context. And so Matthew's Jesus is going to be a teacher. I know over there you prayed and you fasted and you gave alms. Well, over here, I want you to pray too. But not like the prayers over there where they blow a trumpet in the street. Don't fast like they fast with dismal faces. I want you to do these things differently. You have heard it said, but I say unto you, we get a new framing of old teaching in Matthew. I got a telephone call from one of my rabbi friends in Atlanta who said, Tom, could we have lunch? I've got a Christian problem. I said, a Christian problem? What are you talking about, Jeff? He said, I'll tell you at lunch. But when I got to lunch, he said, there is an avant-garde group in my synagogue that has established an interfaith dialogue with a church down the street. I said, good. He said, no, it's not good. I said, Jeff, what's the matter? Don't you believe in interfaith dialogue? He said, yes, I believe in interfaith dialogue. I went to the first meeting, though. There's not enough faith to enter. He said, the Jews don't know the Torah. And the Christians don't know the gospel. He said, in fact, one of the Christians came up to me at the hors d'oeuvre table and she said, don't worry, Rabbi, we're not going to be talking about Jesus. And he said to her, no, you are required to talk about Jesus. He looked at me and he said, somebody's got to stick up for Jesus in this town. I guess it's going to be me. He said, we're not going to have any more interfaith dialogue until the Jews know the Torah and the Christians know their own gospel. That's the Gospel of Matthew. That's the Jesus of Matthew. Forming intelligent, responsible discipleship. Now, this is probably a legendary story, but I love it anyway. It's got to be almost true. About George Buttrick, the famous preacher of a previous generation, who had been at a conference speaking, and he was flying back to New York, and on the plane he had a pad and a pen out, and he was working on his sermon for Sunday. And there was a guy next to him that was eyeing him rather curiously, and finally the curiosity got the best of the guy, and he said,
Man, you are really working hard on something. I hate to interrupt you, but I am so curious. What in the world are you working on? He said, I'm a minister. I'm working on my sermon for Sunday. The guy said, oh, yeah, religion. I don't really like to get all caught up in the ins and outs and complexities of religion. I just like to keep it simple. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. That's all the religion I want. I see, said Buttrick. Well, what about you? What do you do? I'm a professor. I teach at the university. I'm in astrology. Oh, yeah, astrology, said Buttrick. I don't really like to get all caught up in the ins and outs and complexities of astronomy. Twinkle, twinkle, little star. That's all the astronomy I want. The Gospel of Matthew is against twinkle, twinkle, little star theology. And the Jesus of Matthew does parables in order to deepen our understanding of the faith. Let's take a look at one of them, Matthew 13:24. He put before them another parable. The kingdom of heaven may be compared to someone who sowed good seed in his field. But while everyone was asleep, an enemy came and sowed weeds among the wheat and then went away. So when the plants came up and bore grain, then the weeds appeared as well. And the slaves of the householder came and said to him, Master, did you not sow good seed in your field? Where then did these weeds come from? And he answered, An enemy has done this. The slave said to him, Then do you want us to go and gather them? But he replied, No, for in gathering the weeds you would uproot the wheat along with them. Let both of them grow together until the harvest. And at the harvest time, I will tell the reapers, collect the weeds first and bind them in bundles to be burned, but gather the wheat into my barn. Okay. This parable has been powerfully misinterpreted down through the years. What happens in the story, of course, is a man sows some good seed in his field, but then the servants are astonished to see that when the plants are coming up, it's not all good. There are weeds out there as well. And so they go to the guy who sowed the seed, and they said, what's the deal here? Didn't you sow good seed in your field? And he says, yes, I did. Then why are there weeds out there? Well, an enemy has done this. Oh, I got it. Well, then maybe you want us to go out there and take care of the weeds. We'll get rid of them and get it back to a good... No, no, no. Don't do that, because you might damage the wheat by trying to do that. Just leave it to the end. I'll take care of it. I'll tell the reapers to get the good stuff and put it in the barn. We'll burn the bad stuff up when the harvest comes. Now, the misinterpretation of this is Jesus is telling us, don't try to do anything ethical in the world because you might do damage doing it. Just let Jesus handle it at the end. You know, there are drugs being sold down at the middle school. Well, I don't worry about it. We'll take care of it. The woman next door has purple bruises on her face every Monday morning. Don't get involved in that. That's not Jesus, and that is not Matthew. Ethical quietism is not a part of Jesus or a part of Matthew. What I think is going on here is an early version of a theodicy conversation. A theodicy conversation is, if God is good and God is powerful, how come we got all this bad stuff in the world? How come young couples find their first child to have died of SIDS in the morning? How come spina bifida? How come cancer? How come the urge to do warfare again? If this is a good world and you're a good God and a powerful God, how come this? Now, this conversation doesn't solve it, but it addresses it at a very powerful level, because the disciples go to the sower of the seed, who represents God in this case, and they say, hey, look at that field. I thought you were good. I thought you sowed good seed. How come it's like that? Did you intend this? That's the first theodicy question. Did you mean for this to be? Now, before we get an answer to it, I think in the profundity of Matthew's teaching through the parables of Jesus, we get authorization for what is called a theodicy of protest.
of raising the fist at God when we are experiencing these things. Martin Luther once said, we are sometimes closest to God when we raise our fist to heaven, because to do that, you have to trust God. And God has no children more dear than those who trust Him. Did you do this? And the answer is no. Now, this is powerfully profound, but what this does is to dispel all of those responses to evil and suffering in the world that say, well, I know it's hard to lose a child, but God was teaching you something. God was doing this for character building. No, this is God's enemy too. An enemy has done this. This is not my will. This is opposed to my will. Second question. Oh, what a relief. You want us to fix it? As if, you know, here again, as if we could marshal the necessary goods to fix this. I remember a headline in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution after 9/11 that said, Bush vows to rid world of evildoers. Really? And in a deep and mysterious teaching, no, you might damage the wheat. I'm a child who grew up in the 50s, and those of you who grew up in the 50s too remember that every summer was a time of fear that polio was in the land, and some of my friends and your friends maybe got polio. We got it at swimming pools and wherever in the summer. Thanks be to God that we now have polio cured, but we lived with that fear every summer. And one of my dearest friends, a Sunday school girl named Joni, got polio. She was in an iron lung for months and months and months. And then she spent the rest of her life walking with twisted legs and braces. She became an absolutely beautiful woman. An artist. She taught at Georgia State, taught art. She passed away 2 years ago, but if she were to come into this room right now, suddenly the grace level would go up in here. She's just the kind of person who brought beauty and wonder and faith and grace and joy with her. And so I think about her life and I say out of this, did God want her to get polio? No, 1,000 times no. Polio was God's enemy too. Would I have the wisdom to reach into her adult life and take out all the weeds? Would I know how to create this woman of joy and wonder and grace without the things that I disapprove of in her life, the disease that surrounded her? No, I don't have that wisdom. It's a matter of humility and mortality that we are not in the position to pluck the weeds out of the field without doing damage. We don't have that vision. Then the third question. Well, will it always be this way? No. I am telling you that there is coming a time when righteousness will shine like the sun, when every tear will be dried and death and pain will be no more. And this is in the providence of God. If you've ever been to Dachau, the little town in Germany where one of the terrible concentration camps was, there is a museum to the Holocaust on the grounds of the old camp. And in the museum, there is a picture that prompts everyone to pray. Secular, religious, I don't care. You can't look at this picture without praying. It is a picture of a mother and her daughter, her little girl, being marched to the gas chamber at Auschwitz. And there's not one damn thing that the mother can do about it. So she commits the only act of love she has left. She walks behind her daughter and she puts her hands in front of her little girl's eyes so she will not have to see where they're going. And you can't help but pray there, God, don't let that be the last word. Do not let the beast that rises in history have the final word about her or humanity. And the teaching that comes from this parable at the end is, this is not the way that it will always be. This is not the final word. The final word is that righteousness will shine like the sun. It's powerful teaching from the teacher in the Gospel of Matthew. Gospel of Luke, just a bit. The Gospel of Luke, if you were to go to the Church of St. Luke, they don't have a sanctuary and they don't have an educational building. All they have is a fellowship hall. Because in the Gospel of Luke, the way you get to know Jesus is to sit at the table and to feast with Jesus. The communion table is the centerpiece of the life of the Lucan community. And in the 9th chapter of Luke, Jesus is in Galilee and suddenly, like a weather vane, his face turns toward Jerusalem, and he sets his face like a flint to go to Jerusalem. And along the way, it takes 10 chapters for him to get there, but along the way, in what's called the travel narrative in Luke, he reassembles the guest list at the table of God. And all the people who have been left off, the lame and the blind and the weak and the leper and the woman, all of those who have been told that they don't belong at the table, they are regathered around the table in the Gospel of Luke. And the parables in the Gospel of Luke are all about assembling that great feast. Who belongs and who receives the benefit at the table and who sits at the head of the table and so on. And take a look at Luke 12. Someone in the crowd said to him, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the family inheritance with me." But Jesus said to him, "Friend, who set me to be a judge or arbitrator over you?" And he said to them, "Take care. Be on your guard against all kinds of greed, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of possessions." Then he told them a parable. The land of a rich man produced abundantly, and he thought to himself, "What should I do? I have no place to store my crops." Then he said, "I'll do this. I'll pull down my barns and build larger ones, and there I will store all of my grain and my goods, and I will say to my soul, 'Soul, you have ample goods laid up for many years. Relax, eat, drink, and be merry.'" But God said to him, "You fool, this very night your life is being demanded of you, and the things you have prepared, whose will they be?" By the way, just a footnote, this is the only parable we have of Jesus in the New Testament in which God appears as a character explicitly. He appears at the end to say, "Fool." Now, I don't know whether you noticed or not, but this is the parable of the prodigal son with all of the signs reversed. You may remember in the parable of the prodigal son, a man had two sons, and the younger one came to his father, and what did he say? "Divide your inheritance. Give me my share of the inheritance. I want to go off and make a life for myself." This one, someone in the crowd said, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the family inheritance with me." Same question. In the prodigal son, the answer is yes. In this, the answer is no. Then Jesus tells the parable. There was a rich man, and his fields produced abundance, and he had a crisis. "I don't know what to do with all of my abundance." You remember in the prodigal son, it's not a crisis of abundance, it's a crisis of poverty. He went off into the far country and wasted all that he had been given, and suddenly he was in poverty and he was eating what the pigs ate. In both parables, there's a soliloquy where the character, principal character, speaks out loud so that the audience can hear him. In the prodigal son, it's, "What am I going to do? I know what I'll do. I'll throw myself on the mercy of my father." In this one, it's, "What am I going to do? I know what I'll do. I'll build bigger barns." And then in the prodigal son, he comes home, and instead of finding, "You should never," it's, "Get a band, kill the fatted calf, bring a robe, bring a ring, bring sandals. Let's eat and drink and be merry, For my son who was lost is now found. And here it's, I'll say to my soul, eat and drink and be merry, for I have many goods. And in the prodigal son, we end up with the older son being told, son, come on into the party. There's been a party going on for you all your life. You haven't known it. It is fitting to dance and sing. And here it's, fool. It's the same story. The signs are reversed. So what's the difference? What's the contrast? What insight is Luke trying to say with the contrast? This man is a fool, and I'll put this in good theological language. Because he believes he can give himself his own damned party. If you do not participate in the great hospitality of God, but pull off into your own little chamber with your own little table and your own little feast and your own little self-sufficiency, and by the way, I am preaching to myself here, you will miss the great joy that's out there at the banquet table, where the people of God are singing and dancing and eating and drinking with Jesus in the great and joyous feast of the people of God. There's a party out there. Don't miss it. The Greek Orthodox have a notion that right now in heaven, that party is going on. They're singing and dancing, and the saints are swinging from the chandeliers. And every now and then, the floors of heaven open up, and that party falls down into ordinary time and space, and we call it Sunday morning worship. We'll do that tomorrow morning. Thank you for listening. I wonder if you've got questions or rebuttals or comments, anything I said, prick a question or anything you'd like to ask me or say back to me. I would love to hear it.
And I have a question. But because I have the microphone up, I kick it off.
Okay.
My question is a question to bring to a parable in order to discover the reversal. I can see the abundance and excess, and I can also see the last one that's been in my mind right now. But the what?
Confrontation.
Yeah, you can kind of see where you might be confronting power. What question would you ask a parable to find the reversal?
You find at the heart of the parabolic vision of Jesus, I would say, the same vision that you find in the preacher James, who says preacher James in the Bible's preaching to his congregation. He said, there's coming a day when the migrant workers will be on the top and the people in the big house will be on the outside with their noses on the glass looking in. And the great reversal is that the kingdom brings to our culture such a radically different set of values that everything that we think is really, really important when we're in our materialistic mind frames suddenly loses its potency to us when we experience the kingdom. You find for example, in the Gospel of Luke, there's this really interesting parable about this manager who's been messing with his boss's goods and mismanaging the company. And so the boss calls him in and he says, hey, what is this I hear about you? You've been mismanaging. Give me the keys to your desk. And the manager, the guy who's been missing around, says, give me a minute. And he runs out to all the creditors. And he says, how much do you owe my boss? And one of them says, oh, 100 barrels of oil. Make it 50. And he does this for all of the customers, and he ingratiates himself with all of these customers, so that when he has to leave the office, he'll have some friends out there who'll take him in. And people are really bothered by that. They're bothered by that because it's just scurrilous all the way through. And then Jesus makes it worse because he says, I wish my disciples were shrewd like that.
then he adds worse, I want you, like that guy, to take unrighteous mammon and make friends for yourself with it, so that when it fails, they'll receive you into their habitations. It sounds like Jesus is saying, I'd like you to take drug money and casino money and, you know, make friends with it so that when things go bad, you'll have some good friends in the world. But what Jesus is really saying there is, look, the money in your wallet is passing away. It's part... you all have in Nashville what we have in Atlanta, these malls that used to be really great malls in the 60s and 70s and 80s, and now they've got nail salons and, you know, tanning studios, and they're still in business, but there's death all over them. That's the way Luke, that's the way the New Testament views this world. It's still in business, but it's got death all over it. And the money that we have in our bank accounts and our wallets is like Confederate money in 1862. You can still spend it, but it is the temporarily negotiable currency of a failed sovereignty. And so what's going to happen when that fails? And Jesus is saying, all right, you can spend it now, but spend it to make kingdom friends. Because when this world fails, the kingdom friends will receive you into the table. And who are the kingdom friends? When you give a feast, don't give a feast for people who can pay you back. Invite the poor and the lame and the blind and the leper. Because when Abraham is seated at the table, they're going to be in the seats of honor. And they're saving a place. I remember you. You befriended me. And now that the great reversal has happened, here we are, seated at the table. Come on, Tom, says the homeless man on the street in Atlanta. I remember you. You're my buddy. I've been saving you a place. You get the picture there? The whole thing is getting ready to reverse. And so where are our investments? And the parables are undermining this world in favor of urging investments in the next one. And that stunned the crowd into silence. What other questions do you have? There's one.
Lack of parable.
Yeah, that's a very fine question. The question is, how about the book of John? You know, we got parables in Mark and parables in Matthew and parables in Luke. Where are the parables in John? And one commentator on John called it the Maverick Gospel. Because Jesus just talks different in the Gospel of John. In Matthew, Mark, and Luke, the story of Jesus is told in little paragraph size snippets. But if you look at John, you have these long discourses. And in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, Jesus speaks in parables. But he speaks in symbolic imagery in the Gospel of John. And part of it is that John is dealing with a problem that is not dealt with in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, or not dealt with as extensively. John is really dealing with a movement in the early church that we would call hyper-spirituality, an early form of Gnosticism, in which this world is not worth living in. What we should do as Christians is to escape this world into a world of airy spirituality, a disembodied form of mental activity. And so John assumes the structure of that rhetoric and then subverts it. And parables don't fit as neatly into that picture. What does fit into that picture is, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And then that makes all of us spiritual people very happy until we get to the verse that says, and then the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. So he's trying to subvert a Platonic form of discourse
with a kind of twisted Platonic discourse, and parables are more Jewish in form, and so they don't fit as neatly into the rhetoric of John's gospel. That's a great question. Why aren't they there?
There are a lot of references to God's justice, like the weeds being burned. What is your understanding of that?
Her question is, she said it very politely, there are a lot of references to God's justice, like the weeds being burned. What there are some terrible images of sinners being burned up and violent forms of God's activity in the world. And they're mostly, not all, but mostly in Matthew. And my students don't like Matthew. They like John, they like Luke, they like Mark, but Matthew sounds like the assistant principal at the high school. You know, Jesus has always got a judgmental tone. They hear that in there anyway. And part of it is temperamental. Part of it is that Matthew speaks in more Semitic style than any of the other Gospels. You may remember Jesus says, unless you hate your mother and father, no one can be a part of me. That strong kind of hate-love contrast is just the way you order a cab in Beirut, you know, sort of just the way that you speak in a Semitic style. But also, how to put this? For Matthew, in a way that is hard for us to understand, the judgment of God is a good thing, not a bad thing. The wrath of God is not opposed to God's love. It's a form of God's love. So that what is going to be burned up is everything that opposes God's will for human flourishing. When the kingdom comes, there won't be a little child abuse left. It's going to be burned up. There won't be a little cancer still around. Got most of it, but no, there won't be any of it. It'll be burned up. So what's being burned up? He puts it in language that we wouldn't use today. You know, all manners of evildoers will be burned in the fire. We wouldn't put it that way today. What we would put is, that which opposes God's will for human flourishing will not endure. It will be everlastingly put away. So that in Matthew's theology, here's a mature thought, and I am not ready to say it yet, but in maturity, I will hopefully be able to say this. Whatever there is in me that separates me from the love of God, burn, baby, burn. Burn it up. Be done with it. That's really what hell is in the New Testament. It's not a place. It's not a lake of fire and everything. It is where that which is nothing that separates us from the love of God goes to its nothingness, burns to nothingness. So it's actually a good thing. I was going across the campus at Princeton when I was teaching there one day, and one of the students said, Professor Long, I need to say something to you. And I said, well, I'm going to get a cup of coffee. Let's go have coffee and you say it. So we went over, we had a cup of coffee, and what she wanted to tell me was that her supervising pastor in her field education church was requiring her to preach on Sunday, which I said, well, I approve of that. She said, well, I don't, because he's making me preach on the lectionary. I said, well, I approve of that too. And she said, well, I don't. Have you looked at this week's lectionary text? They're about judgment. She said, I do not believe in judgment. I believe in love and grace. I don't believe in judgment. Took me 3 years of therapy to get over judgment. I'm not preaching judgment. We talked about that. And then she changed the subject. She got to talking about their youngest son, a teenager. She said, we're having a hell of a time with him. He's into drugs, maybe selling drugs. He's been in trouble with the police. He's belligerent at home, if he ever comes home. She said, like last night, we were at the kitchen table having supper, and we didn't know where our son was. And all of a sudden, he barrels in the back door. It looks like he's going to kill us. And I said, do you want some supper? And without a word, he just stomped down, slammed his door. And my husband got up, turned on ESPN. That's his response to this all the time. He just goes and watches ESPN. She said, I sat at the table and trembled. She said, I'm afraid of my own son physically. I'm
afraid of him. But something got into me that night, and I got up and went down to his room, and I pushed open the door, and I said, "You listen to me. I love you so much, I'm not putting up with this." And I said, "Carolyn, I think you have just preached a sermon on judgment. The God who loves us so much, God's going to set things right." That's at the heart what I think is in those passages. If I were rewriting the Bible, I could put it in a lot better language. Let's call it quits. Thank you so much for coming today.